From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Before there was Jackie Robinson, there were Alejandro Carrascal, Roberto Ortiz, Roberto Estalella, and numerous other Latino players who, according to Adrian Burgos Jr., constituted the main group used to test the limits of racial tolerance as it applied to Major League Baseball. Adrian Burgos Jr. is the author of Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line, which tells the stories of the aforementioned players and many more. His book also speaks to the circumstances of current Latino major leaguers. We had the opportunity to talk this week, and I began by citing a statistic in Playing America's Game. Mr. Burgos points out that 13 of the 16 teams that made up Major League Baseball in 1947, Jackie Robinson's first year, employed at least one Latino. I asked him how those players were defined in terms of baseball's color line.
Well, the way they were defined, really, in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, they were viewed as lighter-skinned Latinos, Latins, and oftentimes where emphasis was on their national background to distinguish them from being black. And in fact, my argument is that during this earlier period, we really saw the efficacy of the color line being played out by seeing how selective these major league teams were and which Latinos they allowed to enter into the major leagues and which one they kept out.
Well, as you're suggesting, one of the things that made some of the Latino players attractive to the owners of the major league teams is they could be presented as, quote, the purest bars of Castilian soap. This is at least according to one of the owners involved, meaning, I guess, that even if they were from Cuba, they could be considered European.
Indeed, that was what they wanted to specify. And that story itself is ironic on one level, in that Castilian soap is actually black.
And...
and so, but Cincinnati being the home of Procter & Gamble and Ivory Soap, it spoke to their knowledge of race in trying to connote whiteness through soap. The other part to that story is that Frank Bancroft, who was the business manager of the Cincinnati Reds, was the individual who mobilized the Cincinnati Reds signing of these two Cubans in 1911, Rafael Almeida and Armando Marsans. Mm-hmm. And he had brought the very first team of high-level professional ball players to Cuba in 1879. And Bancroft made several trips to Cuba. And he knew, and he communicated to others, that there's a particular hierarchy of ethnic types among Cubans and that Castilians were seen as the most pure of the Spanish who came to Cuba.
Well, you're bringing up a point with when you talk about the quality of the players and how early Latinos played in this country. One attraction of the Latino players 50 and more years ago was they were very good, at least as measured by how well major league teams like the Reds and the Tigers did when they played barnstorming games in Cuba.
Indeed. What we saw was that the Cuban player teams brought in actually African-American players from the Negro Leagues, and with that addition, they were extremely competitive against the barnstorming North American teams. And it took John McGraw's New York Giants in 1910 to reassert Major League Baseball supremacy. But that was after both Ben Johnson and Gary Herman made these very vocal statements about we must ban intact major league teams from going down to Cuba because if they're not getting beaten, they're not asserting the supremacy of big league baseball down there the way they want it to.
We've all read about the racism that Jackie Robinson encountered when he joined the Dodgers in 1947. Never mind opposing players and some fans, Robinson had teammates who wouldn't have anything to do with him. Did the Latinos playing during the same time have the same problems?
Some Latinos did, and in fact, here's where we see the differences between the lighter-skinned Latino and the darker-skinned Latinos come into play. That is, the lighter-skinned Latinos could at times really bond with their white teammates and, in a certain sense, get access to some of the things that their darker-skinned teammates, both Latino and African-Americans, could not. And so here we see the case, I think, Minnie Minoso really brings this out, where as a darker-skinned Latino, as a black Latino, he faced racism both from within his own cultural group and also from the U.S. society, as well as the cultural barriers of language, of adaptation to different foods, different customs. And in Minoso's case, he handled it with much grace. And you know, for me, he's one of the individuals who most powerfully captures the dynamics that Latinos have to face in Major League Baseball and in acclimating to U.S. society at that point in time. A short story about Minoso would be that he didn't really have what many people presumed was the fraternity among Latinos. Many people supposed because Minoso had a Latino manager, actually Spanish-born, Al Lopez, that Minoso was, in a certain sense, secure because he had that harbor of a manager. Well, many would tell you, in maybe perhaps a private moment, that he and Al Lopez didn't necessarily see eye to eye. Al Lopez was not very forgiving to the other Latino players, and he wasn't very forgiving to the darker-skinned Latino players. In fact, he rode him a little harder. And so, on the one hand, we would expect that a Latino manager in that instance would actually work in his favor, and many will tell you, Al Lopez traded me both times he had me on his team.
Your book presents lots of stories that emphasize how foolish and arbitrary it is to characterize people by color. One of my favorites concerns Carlos Bonilla. Tell us about what happened when he was in spring training with the Brooklyn Dodgers in the late 40s.
This was a story discovered by Jules Tigil in his book, Baseball's Great Experiment. And Carlos Bonilla was a Puerto Rican ball player who came to spring training with the Dodgers and roomed with the white teammates in the hotel. But a couple of sunny days there in Florida, he got too much of a tan, and he was forced to leave the white hotel and join the African-American and black teammates away from Daytona Beach.
Somebody had to come up to him and say, Carlos, hey, sorry, pal. You're black now. You can't stay here anyway. I mean, this is just so ridiculously absurd that it's practically beyond belief.
Yeah, it's nice that we can laugh at it now, but you can imagine what it was that Carlos Bonilla must have felt at that moment where the person does come up to him and says, you know, by the way, you can't stay here anymore.
You point out that Roberto Clemente and many other great players were often made to look foolish by newspaper reporters who would present what the players said along the lines of, baseball been very, very good to me. Does it seem to you that this is still happening?
I think at different times it slips up. I think writers tend to be a bit more careful about their writing and a bit more sensitive. But as we saw with the Sammy Sosa corked bat case, it can easily slide back in when he was quoted in it by an AP Wire story phonetically. And that shows there that there's these racial filters at times that we govern ourselves by, but in other times we slip up, or some of us slip up, and allow race to really dominate the perception. And the significance of this is that how do you portray someone as Latino in the public's mind as they read? Well, in part, it's by trying to present them phonetically. Why is that significant? Well, for us who study Latinos, in part, it's significant because they're trying to portray the significance on the accent and not what on the individual is actually saying. And the significance of that being that it portrays these ball players as less intelligent, and they're mostly communicating in a second language.
Of course, Sosa didn't do himself any favors when, appearing before a congressional committee, he pretended that he didn't have enough English to be able to understand their questions and answer them. He wanted a translator.
Indeed, he did not stand very well there or sit very well there. And in fact, it's interesting because it really brings out the dynamic of how, at times, these ball players are fully aware, and talking about here the Latina ball players, of the racial circumstances of what's going on, and how at times it's a performance of how we portray ourselves to the public. And in this instance, Sammy tried to shield himself in this performance of a foreign Latino that other times he shed and tried to welcome as he was trying to market himself to a broader public as an ad spokesperson. It was a calculated performance, indeed, and it's not the first instance. Some of us say that his public persona is also a performance of a particular type of individual.
Adrian Burgos Jr. is the author of Playing America's Game, published by University of California Press. He joined me from the studios of WILL in Urbana, Illinois. Professor Burgos, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
My conversation with Adrian Burgos Jr. will be featured in Saturday's program. We'll also be wrestling with such controversies as the referee scandal that's worrying NBA Commissioner David Stern so seriously that he has called it the worst thing that's happened to the league on his watch. We'll look back at the week the Tour de France has had, and then, perhaps to get as far from that event as possible, we'll visit the World Eskimo Indian Olympics in Anchorage. We'll read from your letters as well, and we'll hope not to jinx the Chicago Cubs with our story about how well they've been playing lately. So join us, and remember you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.